Park Place Meeting, Sunday afternoon, 20th June, 1976. One question has already been put to me. How can one diminish the ego? Do not attempt to diminish the ego. We'll see the reason why. What is this quality of egoism due to? It is perhaps predominantly a form of self-conceit. Conceit. I am somebody, I am a great man. I am important. I am going to do this, that and the other. I am going to assert myself and so forth. It is a form of aggressiveness. This has to be understood by us. The big ego means that here is a person who is very powerful. He has lots of energy, lots of power. He could do things. Probably. He may have a conceit which is quite ungrounded, true enough. But leaving that aside, the conceit means that here is somebody who really could do things. This tremendous energy within the self, which shows itself as aggressive self-conceit, has to be transformed. The power, the energy represented by that aggressiveness and conceit will then be utilized, will naturally express itself in forms which are beneficial. If I try to suppress my ego, then I only make matters worse. All sorts of unhappy consequences to that. But if I remain mindful and watch when, where, how this aggressive expression of my energies takes place, then that aggressiveness will disappear. Aggressiveness is always associated with a strong sense of otherness. Everybody else is something other than I. But if one understands all that, then the otherness vanishes and right relationship arises. In right relationship, there is friendliness. There is cooperativeness. There is the power to work in with another person. To respond sensibly, harmoniously to the situation, whatsoever it may be. Then this aggressiveness changes, it gets transformed into cooperativeness. But the power remains, and the power, the energy gets enhanced with that. Because now, in right relationship, you are not opposing, you are not in conflict. And if you are not in conflict, there is no wastage of energy. there is right expression of energy. And you are helped both by the situation and by any other person or persons with whom you are in relationship. Because egoism must have a situation, must have other people in relation to whom this egoism expresses itself. So it's not a question of diminishing the ego. It is a question of understanding. And with that understanding and cooperativeness, the self-conceit disappears, as well as the aggressiveness. You see? Something like this can happen. Always this supreme instrument of salvation which exists in us. Our capacity to be mindful. In pure mindfulness, one understands. The mindfulness has to be pure. The man who is intent upon self-aggrandizement is also mindful. The businessman, the executive, the one in charge, and everybody is mindful to some degree or other. But it has to be the right sort of mindfulness. It has to be pure mindfulness. Pure mindfulness essentially means to be alert, fully awake, as fully observant as possible, without any desire animating you, without any reactions for or against what you observe. Then the observing becomes a pure observing. And you see the truth of things. And there is a way for resolving this problem of the ego. We have every one of us has natural self-conceit. And I yield second place to none in having gone through it in my young days. Now, any other questions?
Would you go so far as to say the bigger, the greater the ego, like St. Paul, who was on the way to Damascus, the greater the power for good, the greater the sinner?
The strong man can lift a heavier weight than the weak man. It's just like that.
Rose, if the ego, you know, we shouldn't have reactions to these things. Does it mean that when you're walking out and you see a beautiful flower, a beautiful rose, that you shouldn't exclaim? I mean, it's there to enjoy its beauty. I mean, if you sort of stay on one level, I mean, you might be a vegetable.
No, that is quite a mistaken view. Look. Through our entire sense life, that means all the day in the waking state, certainly, you see, through our entire sense life, there is the psychical response which is associated with the psychical I like, I want. I don't like, I don't want. You see? To see a thing, to hear something, smell something, and to be fully awake and aware of what it actually is associated with pure joy. See? But when either attachment or aversion enters into the situation, the relationship is a relationship of bondage, not a free and an open relationship. And it is this which spoils the whole thing. Be as sensitive as possible to every single impression that comes to you. Sensitive. And you absorb it and are free from being bound by attachment because you like it's pleasant, or by aversion because you dislike it's unpleasant. See, this is the point about it. Look, this has been one of the tragic things in connection with the living of the religious life through the ages. No wonder that thousands of people say, oh, to be religious means to be miserable. It doesn't mean that at all. If you try to live the religious life and your living of the religious life is productive of mere misery, then believe me, that is the irreligious life. Look at all these nuns and sisters as they go about their work. They are constantly smiling. They have to exercise a tight rein on their girlishness. It is impossible to avoid happiness, true happiness, because the whole of nature is constantly pouring beauty and the wonderful things to make you really joyous. If there is no reaction in terms of grasping, wanting, and if you can't have it, there is envy, there is jealousy, there is a struggle to obtain it, and all the subhuman elements come into play. But if you enjoy it absolutely purely, completely, fully, you see, yourself not getting attached or getting feeling aversion, then how will you prevent yourself from being happy? I ask you. Of course, you will ask me the question, the impressions that come in upon us today through the news are all doom-gloom impressions. Yes, don't therefore turn off the news. It is your school for learning to be free of aversion, hate, malevolence, ill will, anger, the disturbance of inward poise, the upsetting of inward poise. It's a terribly difficult school, admittedly. One's own losses, serious positions, illness in the family, your own illness, all these things which cause pain, as we say. Surely, they cause sorrow, they cause grief. But they are our school for learning. And you will find that as and when the religious does learn inwardly, and this inward learning is very difficult to describe, as you learn, there is a release of a peculiar happiness which is totally beyond all sensation. It has nothing to do with sensation. And it is a power for healing, starting with yourself and going outwards to the environment. These are very difficult lessons to learn, of course. I mean, we are not attempting something mediocre. Perfection, fruition. What do they mean? The great symphonies, the great poems, the wonderful works of art, they are examples. Sheer perfection. Do you think that is easy? Ask the great composers, the great poets, the great writers. tears, toil, sweat, and blood. Even for a little thing like this book, passages have been written again and again 18 times in order to make it all right. And months of hard work, sheer toil and sweat. You see? No, it's not easy. But that is how it is. And then there is the inner freedom, the release, which is the state of true joy, not the pleasure that I have produced something good. That's nonsense. Once you have created something, it is out of you. You see? And you are open in the now to what is new and what will emerge. So the religious life really is full of joy if one is intelligent about it all. One isn't at first, because one just doesn't know. But live it. Persevere. Be patient. And you will take everything in your stride.
Could I? Sorry, yes, can I ask please. You say that when you look at something which is nice for you without grasping, you can experience joy. And when you look at something which is horrible to you without aversion, you don't then feel joy. You feel love, or what does one feel?
Love, compassion, sorrow.
Sorrow.
Look, love includes both sorrow and joy. What is love? Love is a power that unites, that relates everything perfectly, that makes the wholeness of it. In the wholeness, there are positions of high tension, there are positions of ease. You see? The things which are sorrowful and terrible and hurtful in life are positions of high tension. Just as those experiences in life which are ecstatic, you see, are also positions of high tension. One ordinarily reacts with aversion to the unhappy and with pleasure and desiring to possess with the happy, you see. But both of them, gone through rightly, means that you don't hold on to the shape of things. They have become things, the shape has become something of the past. You don't hold on to it. If you have learned the lesson out of it, you will find the aftermath of intense sorrow is a calm joy. You say to yourself, yes, now I understand. And in that understanding, there is peace, there is compassion, there is love, there is true stability. The stability of pure, free being, not the stability of forcibly keeping something in a place. These are deep things, but they do take place.
How do you apply this when... How do you apply this characterization that you just gave to a society in which there's a great deal of political evil, social evil, where there is a great disparity between the wealthy and the poor?
I can't apply it to society, to people in the mass. These are things of individual growth. You see? The individual has to perceive, understand, and become free from within himself. Purified and free from within himself. Now, every individual is related to the society around him. We can't shut that out at all. Even if we lived in a cave or in a cloister, if you lived alone in a cave, you have to go down into the village to get some food. You can't live permanently without food. You may for 3 or 4 days, or even 7 or 8 days or something, you see. But you have to go down into the village. You'll come in contact with a living person or more living persons. You can't avoid it, you see. Now, because the individual is wholly and completely interrelated with society, according to what he himself is, will be his influence upon those around him. Supposing, for instance, I was a drunkard and a scoundrel and all the rest of it, but had the gift of the gab and could talk high-sounding things, you see. Very soon you'd discover what sort of a person I am. Wouldn't take you very long. As you see me emerge from the pub, reeling, you see. Would you keep coming here?
Maybe.
Brave lady. You see, it's like that. So now, the influence on people in the mass depends upon the power of the perfection within you. It is a radiance, an influence that goes out of you. Supposing you have an extremely powerful electric or magnetic field, well, it will affect a wide area. If it is a weak one, it will affect a small area, won't it? It's like that. You can't compel society into goodness. If that could have been done, the religions of the world with their teachings would have done it thousands of years ago. Have they? You can't compel the other fellow to be good. You can't even tell him what is good for him. If he is interested, comes to you and says, "Shankara, you look so happy and peaceful, how do you manage it?" Then tell him a little bit, not too much. Tell him just a little bit and see how he responds to it. Then you are interplaying with him in the right way, not like the cat and the mouse. The people who deliberately go out to do good to others, you see, and make them better folk, it's a cat and mouse situation. And the poor old mouse is permanently in heaven afterwards.
When they asked Jesus about this good and evil, he gave them the parable of the seeds. And he said, "Let the seeds grow, and don't weed the weeds out. Let the tares grow with the good wheat. Let them all grow up together." Isn't that the same thing here? Don't try to root out the evil. Separate it from the wheat. He said they'll all be cut down together.
They'll all be cut down together. No, my memory is a little bit weak upon that portion of the Gospel. I can't say anything about that at the moment.
You mentioned something about the great composer and the great artistic endeavors and what pain, you know, it does cause, perhaps, you know, or difficulties that have to be encountering on through before these great works are produced. But perhaps on a lesser level, can you say something about the nature of the artistic urge, and in what circumstances it can be regarded as being, may I say, to use a sort of a popular phrase, an ego trip.
Again, I can't say much about that. It may be an ego trip, it may not. You see, supposing my forte is my professional work, and supposing I just enjoyed painting or something in addition. Take, for instance, teaching chemistry was something which was my professional work and which I thoroughly enjoyed, absolutely. It was really my vocation. And I was absolutely happy doing my professional work. Supposing, in addition to that, I was interested in painting or music and enjoyed it a little bit, or perhaps could compose a little bit or something, all right, I just enjoyed myself. I don't know whether that would be an ego trip. If I showed off with it deliberately, then it would be an ego trip. But if that is not the case, it is a happy expression of what faculties you are gifted with, and I think it adds to the happiness and beauty of life for yourself and those around you, and so on. It is when there is this element of aggressiveness and self-conceit, a measuring of oneself against the other person, that the trouble comes, the egoism comes.
Yes, I'm just thinking in terms perhaps of the modern manifestations of our pop art and that sort of thing, which perhaps are genuine artistic expressions in some respects, but there are other manifestations which are perhaps genuinely an aggressive act of the nature which you were saying, just for purely commercial reasons and so on, which clearly aren't within the terms of that. But the question I was wanting to was, if I don't know whether you were able to analyse a little bit more fully the sort of the general nature of this artistic urge, you know, this urge to create, how it comes through with people who perhaps aren't necessarily talented, but there is perhaps still this urge to do, but an inherent disappointment in their achievements.
I really don't know whether I can say anything about it. The urge to create beautiful things, you see, is of course an urge. One can never blame such a thing. It is a blameless urge, surely. You see? And if one has any gift at all along those lines, one may cultivate it and express it. See, there again is a case of life presenting you with something which is happy. Oh, be happy with it.
Rose?
Yes?
Can I ask you something of the nature of a creative artist? Why most great creative artists are unhappy people? Although they produce transcendent...
The inborn gift of sheer genius is inexplicable. One may say just very generally, the constitution, the structure of the brain is such that it is just naturally responsive, completely open to archetypal energies operating through that person. I'm sure it has basically a great deal to do with the structure of the brain. And the mysteries of the brain we are just beginning to unravel in terms of scientific knowledge and accurate information. We don't know. We have always said, gifted by God. And there we are speaking truly, not associating the idea of a personal being or a particular theological conception with the word God. The word God there just stands for something quite beyond me, the little human being. Now, why is such a man unhappy? That part of the brain, which is this sensitive receptacle for such extraordinary influences, and that part of the brain which has this natural gift to make a proper structure, perfect artistic structure, and of course one of the finest examples we have in the world of music is Mozart, born a most extraordinary genius, you see. But the rest of the brain, the rest of the organism, is not like that. You see? Let me just tie this up with this Kundalini Yoga business. He who disciplines himself in the right way alters the brain structure without his knowing it, so that his sensitivity and the power to receive on all planes and in several ways is the equivalent of what the genius is gifted with. And up to a point he can turn on the tap deliberately, which your genius can't. He can't turn on the tap deliberately. It's true that, the very great composers and others have had to produce pot boilers. They had to do pot boiling in order to get a little bread and enough butter to make the bread shine, and so forth. But the yogi has something different. Now why is he why are they unhappy in their lives? In their lives they are ordinary humans. Look at Beethoven, a most ill-tempered, unpleasant person to live with. No manners, a filthy, dirty creature he was. He'd invite his friends, his aristocratic friends, you see, and they would see a chamber pot and they'd avert their eyes, you see, unemptied. And things like that. This was Beethoven. Look at the music that came out of him. God in heaven. Especially those last works during his last years. What an output. Especially from the time of the Choral Symphony onwards. The Missa Solemnis, the Choral Symphony, those last quartets, they absolutely go right into the heart of transcendence itself. At least that is my response to it, you see. To this day, the great musicians and those who understand music, they openly speak of Beethoven in sort of terms of awe and reverence. You see, and give marvelous analyses of those late works, and so on. Well, this happened through this kind of man, who as a social being was thoroughly unsocial. Of course, there was the affliction of his deafness, and that must have caused extraordinary sorrow inside him. But thank goodness he was deaf. That's a strange thing to say. Sounds a very cruel thing to say. But truly, thank goodness he was deaf. Because being deaf, his being turned inwards into its innermost depths, and they were left open to receive this impress of the transcendent. His inner being was not distracted by the outer things. You see, Beethoven said, "He who understands my music will be freed of all sorrow." A most extraordinary statement for a human being to make. Especially him who suffered as few people ever suffered, through his own defects and through the affliction of the deafness and so forth. You see? But how does this happen? Here was a soul that was extremely sensitive, in fact, to difficulty, to sorrow. In his childhood he went through great sorrow, great misery and pain. His father was a foolish man and a harsh man, you see, and so forth. And he adored his mother, and she died when Beethoven was quite young. And he more or less became the supporter of the family and so forth. See, he knew sorrow from the beginning. He saw sorrow around him. The wars of Napoleon and being bombarded and all the rest of it. And he saw the sight of these soldiers maimed and lacerated, being carried on carts for treatment and all the rest of it. He saw things like that. Now here was this intensely sensitive soul, knowing sorrow to the extreme, in extreme measure. Now, what happens with a soul like that? He suffers. He doesn't throw out the suffering. He doesn't repress it. He absorbs it in his own being. He knows his own genius. He knows he can touch God, touch transcendence itself. He knows that within his own being. And this sorrow is transmuted. It is absorbed in his psyche, and the touch of transcendence through his particular art is the response. And you get this marvelous music. Have you ever noticed the extraordinary peace and poise and utter ethereality, particularly of his slow movements? You see, there it is.
Did he say this about sorrow late in life, or?
I think, I can't quite remember. When I was a child, I absolutely devoured book after book about Beethoven. Not when I was a child, in my adolescence, years of adolescence. I think it was after the Heiligenstadt will. That's 1801 or 2, when he was 31 or 2. Because then the deafness was getting definite. But it was not till 1818 or 19 that he became totally deaf. Certainly after composing the Hammerklavier Sonata, he was completely deaf. I mean, think of all the works after the Hammerklavier.
So how old would he have been then, when he became completely deaf?
1818. He was born in 1870.
17.
So 30 plus 18, 48 years. And he died in 1827. When he was 56 and a quarter years old. And in those last years of utter deafness and terrible ill health, he had the most awful ill health, those last quartets came out. My God.
Would you say that it is necessary to have deep soil in order to create great works of art?
Look, we have to be very careful with this sort of thing. You ask, is it necessary to have great sorrow? It is quite unnecessary to have the whole heap of sorrow which we bring upon ourselves unnecessarily, foolishly, and willfully, and so forth. You see, it's quite unnecessary. But as you grow to the full stature of your humanity, you become more and more sensitive to the woe of the world around you. You see, it is impossible to shut out sorrow. And to attempt to shut out sorrow is one of the greatest mistakes we can make. Because this is an instrument through which the power of compassion grows stronger and stronger. And if you have not compassion, if you have not charity, St. Paul, Epistle to the Corinthians, you know that wonderful chapter 13.
Like sounding a brass or a tinkling
cymbal. You see? And it is this sorrow which awakens your complete insight into the fact that the supreme ill, the supreme dukkha, is being out of relationship, not in complete relationship with totality, with the transcendence. That is why it is said, the path of a Buddha is filled with unutterable woe. Jesus is called the man of sorrows, and so forth, you see. You mustn't think that sorrow is a technique for gaining a desired or a happy end. Oh no. This sorrow will always be with us. Do not try to shut it out. Respond rightly to it as it comes.
When joy sits at your table, sorrow lies sleeping on your bed.
Rose, could I ask you to comment on the words, they know not what they do, with regards to the Father?
Forgive them.
With regards to us, actually.
Oh, so many things are involved in it.
Just for a moment, I appreciate it.
Would it be covered by the word ignorance?
They know not what they do. First, let me touch upon a statement attributed to the Buddha. The worst sins are patricide, matricide, defiling the bed of the teacher, because so many of the Brahmin teachers were married men, you see, and so forth. Drawing the blood of a Buddha, wounding him, or killing one of any arhant, any holy man, the perfected holy ones. Those are the great sins. And they are the ones which are said to send a person into avicii, you see, into the deepmost hell. Like Dante put Satan, Judas, and Beelzebub in the innermost circle, the tenth circle of hell, in the center of hell, you see. Judas, as a traitor, treated as a traitor, although that's, I think, a mistaken view. He didn't betray anything. He did what destiny had appointed him to do. Now, Jesus says, forgive them, they know not what they do. They do not understand the enormity of this act of crucifying him and its consequences. You know, the Christian world is inclined to say that the sufferings of the Jews after the crucifixion through the centuries are at least partly due to their having murdered the Son of God. That playwright, Dorothy somebody?
Dorothy Sayers
talks of the crucifixion as the murder of God, doesn't she?
Man born to be king.
Yes, the man born to be king. You see, the murder of God. Now, the insight of the sinless one, of the Holy One, is so perfect that he knows the terrible consequences that will flow out of an act of that sort. And he says, Father, forgive them. He uses the term Abba. Abba is the word for father in Hebrew. Abba. The Ba sound means also the son of. But of course they have an R. So and so Bar, Simon Bar Jonah, B-A-R. And yet I have read that one of the meanings of Abba means the son of Ab, the infinite, the void, the unknown, the ultimate unknown, the son of the unknown. You see? The Father in heaven. And heaven is associated with wisdom. You remember when talking about the Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic tree, this and that or the other, we talked about it a little bit. Now, what could be the consequence of such an act? It would of necessity be a terrible consequence. And Jesus prays, forgive them. You see, that is to say, let justice be tempered by mercy. What more can I say? They know not what they do. They are ignorant. This ignorance expressing itself in terms of violence, of the clinging to fixed dogmas. The Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, is a male God, which is an absurdity really on the part of the Jews, because the very word Yahweh, Yod Heh Vav Heh, is positive negative, male female, in one. The divine hermaphrodite is Yahweh. Father, mother in one, actually. So many things are involved. It's difficult to answer the question.
It's the know not what they do part that's interesting.
Well,
how much we know, we actually know what we do when we do wrong, or whether we are able to deceive ourselves.
Yes, they know not what they do, meaning that they are ignorant of the nature of what they are doing. Killing him. You see?
When we do wrong, do we know what we do? Always?
Not always. But on the whole, we generally do know
Would we have known better earlier in our lives, do you think? Or
do we know better later in our lives?
Earlier. When we're children, do we see the difference between right and wrong more clearly than when we get older?
There is a natural sensitivity within us, which somehow just knows. You know how a dog or a cat, your pet dog or cat, and they are caught in the act, and how they slink away. How do they know? But they don't know. And children are the same, somehow.
Didn't the Buddha say the same thing? If brothers are carving you limb from limb, have not one bad thought.
Yes, that is part of the discipline. Part of the discipline. Because, he says, even if low-down thieves were to carve you limb from limb, even then, if you were to harbor any enmity against them, then you are not doers of my teaching. Those are his exact words, as put in the Pali Canon, you see. And he gives the, he says, you should therefore train yourselves thus. Neither will we let our minds be perverted and feel enmity against them. See? Nor shall we react in any way against them. But we shall let our minds, we shall fill our own minds with loving kindness, and let that loving kindness spread to them, to all others, till it becomes great, immeasurable, pervades all the quarters of the world. That is the teaching he gives.
Seems impossible, doesn't it?
Turn the other cheek. Love those who hate you. It's easy to say such things, just short aphoristic sentences.
Resist not evil. Resist not evil.
Yes, that is related to it. But here is the positive statement of what you should do.
Love those who hate you and despitefully use you.
Exactly, and despitefully use you. You see, the great teachers themselves were perfect psychologists. Absolutely perfect psychologists. And they must have explained to their own followers and disciples the psychology of the whole process so that the disciples understood. But what has come down to us in writing is just the cream of the stuff, like shorthand, like a shorthand note of the important points, that's all. And all the explanation left out. So these aphoristic statements. If you ever try to read the Brahma Sutras, which were written by Badarayana, you see, which were written by him, my goodness, it's almost impossible to know what he's talking about. That is the extreme example of these very short aphoristic statements. And so these are the Beatitudes and so forth, are like these aphoristic statements.
Did they say it because they realized that to harbor hatred would do more harm to the victims than any harm the rock could do?
Oh, unquestionably. When we react with hate or any sort of violent feelings inside us, the chemical reactions that go on are actually harmful to one's health. That is a fact well known. Again, it's the same with anxiety. Anxiety gives rise to ulcers and all sorts of things like that. See, the organism is a very intimately interwoven psychophysicality. We separate psyche and body, mind and body, when we talk about these things. But they are not separate, they are one whole thing. We have to wake up to the fact of the oneness, the integrated oneness of the total universe. This integration, it's a living integration, it's a grown into each other, not just brought together and then you have nails or nuts and bolts and mechanically held together. It's not mechanically held together. It's livingly woven, interwoven, and when we sort of wake up to that, then we have the right sort of carefulness in all that we do.
What does one do about aggression?
What does one do about aggression?
Yes, the force of aggression. It makes people so impatient.
Well, we have already talked about it. Be mindful. Be mindful.
But then you feel all bottled up inside.
Note the feeling of being bottled up. Just look at it. You see, there is no other medicine for the psyche. Examination, diagnosis, medicine, healing, the cure, are all one and the same thing in the psyche, unlike the body. The body has separate parts which remain separate. Here is a liver, here is a kidney, here is the heart, here is this, that and the other, you see. And they all function now, maintaining their separate organic nature, you see. The psyche is not like that. The psyche is like space. Can you carve up space and say, this space is such and that space is such? Try and do it, see if you can. The psyche is like that.
May I ask something different, Rose? I hope I can explain what I mean. When you talk about life, our life, in relation to death, do I take it that it is only through understanding, real understanding, that there is no death? That death is non-understanding, and that we die if we do not truly understand.
Look, the entire manifested world process, and throughout the universe, everything is in movement, everything is changing, right? Where so many changes are concerned, we can see the relationships between that which held at this moment and that into which it is transformed so many moments later. We see and can understand the transforming process. It is, in the ordinary way, not of a nature which is so stark, so immense, that we haven't got the ability to understand and recognize it as a transformation. You see? This phenomenon of death is a phenomenon of that sort. The change which has taken place is a completely irreversible change where that particular creature is concerned. Its irreversibility is that which defeats us. You see? If you if you study science, you study chemistry, say, you will see so many cases of chemical changes which are irreversible. A great many of them are reversible changes. The reaction between two chemicals can proceed this way, and then because of the functioning of, say, laws like the law of mass action, as we call it, the reaction begins to go that way, and so on and so on, you see. We see all that, and we understand it in terms of science. But when the irreversible reaction takes place, the irreversible change takes place, where living beings are concerned, especially those who are near and close to us, we are just stricken. Our intellect, our mind, our awareness is stricken suddenly so hard with this stark unanswerability of death, you see, that we get upset. Now, if it is possible to maintain total attentiveness, we will see it as a transformation only and not as an annihilation. Because we are struck hard with this irreversibility, it feels to us as if it was an annihilation. And that is what terrifies and upsets our balance.